You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
From Literary Hub, where we believe that every issue that shows up in your Twitter feed or on the evening news has already been tackled somewhere in literature. I'm Whitney Terrell, the author of the novel The Good Lieutenant.
And I'm Vivi Ganeshanathan, also known as Sugi, the author of the novel Love Marriage.
And also known as the person who consistently tries to start an NCAA March Madness women's bracket, but never gets anybody to go along with it.
Ugh, true. Sad and true. I've been trying to do that basically since high school, but people never feel like they know enough about the women's side of the tournament to bet.
People filling out brackets know anything about the men's side either. Just saying.
I mean, yeah, exactly. What's holding them back? So, and you know, I'm a women's basketball fan and I live in Minneapolis where we love the Lynx. Everyone here is huge fans.
Were you a basketball player?
I was briefly a basketball player and then had a really mean coach in the sixth grade and quit basketball and also ended up quitting soccer and stuck with tennis and returned to soccer later. But I stayed sort of throughout like a huge basketball reader. And I had this eternally checked out double biography of Magic Johnson and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar that I read on the sidelines of the tennis court, actually, about 400 times. And yeah. So I like went and looked it up, actually, because I was curious for this episode. I think it was Jerry Bronfield's Lakers book, which is like a double biography and came out in 81. Did you play basketball at all?
Yeah, I totally did. My whole life up through high school. And then I didn't play. I really stopped playing after that. I played soccer in college, and that was the end of my basketball career. We're going to talk about some more basketball and sports generally today. On the second half of the show, we'll be joined by Shira Springer of WBUR, which is Boston's NPR affiliate. She's a longtime sports writer, but first, we're excited to welcome our friend, novelist Marcus Burke. Marcus played varsity college basketball at Susquehanna University for 4 years before earning his MFA from the Iowa Writers' Workshop. He's the author of the novel Team 7, which earned a starred review from Kirkus and was longlisted for the 2015 Penn Open Book Award and was one of the 10 titles to pick up now in O, the Oprah magazine. Marcus is now on the creative writing faculty at the Mountain View MFA program, but he's about to join the faculty at Texas Tech. Marcus, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me. Glad to talk with you guys.
Yeah, We're thrilled to have you here, and Whit and I are both basketball fans, and March Madness is upon us, and it's the happiest time of the year, right? With your basketball, I guess it depends on your team, but with your basketball background, are you a big fan of any specific teams, or are there any teams that you follow closely throughout the season?
I can't lie. If you've seen Duke this year, they've got Zion Williamson. He is, I don't know, he's in a league of his own athletically. I mean, his athleticism is, the only thing to compare him to is LeBron, really.
Has he been playing in the tournament, in the conference tournament? Because I know he stayed out after he blew his shoe out in the game against North Carolina. And then I heard that he was going to come back for the conference tournament. Has that happened? Do you know?
Yeah, he played last night. Ah. And He went 13 for 13 from the field. He's not better.
Dang. Well, I'm a KU fan, so we're not allowed to like Duke around here.
I mean, good Lord. No one likes Duke. I was, I was on a flight recently, and I pulled, someone had left a bunch of magazines in the pocket in front of me, and then I'm a longtime Michigan fan. I taught at Michigan for 5 years, but I actually grew up as a I sort of learned to watch college basketball by watching the Fab Five. And I know UConn. And I also spent part of my childhood in Connecticut and so was sort of part of watching those basketball teams and sort of part of that fandom as well at one point. But I still, I can't look away from Zion Williamson. My God, just amazing. And so I pulled this magazine out of the back and sort of realized I had stumbled upon an article that was Duke fandom and it was by a writer who had graduated from Duke. And I was like, oh God, what's happened to me?
Yeah. he's unreal.
Do you have any family members who you talk basketball with, or friends who you're on the opposite sides of the aisle with, Marcus?
Not really. My family is West Indian, so growing up, they were more into soccer.
Yeah, that's what I played in college.
And most of my friends, no, not really. no, I mean, I had a teammate in college. He was from Harrisburg. We always used to kind of have our city wars, but that wasn't really college.
So if your family was into soccer, how did you become a basketball player?
Honest to goodness, I remember it was the NBA Finals, the year that Shaquille O'Neal was on the Orlando Magic and he was playing the Houston Rockets in mm-hmm. the finals. I remember that year. I'm not sure how old I was. It might have been like second or third grade maybe. And I remember just watching that finals and I don't know, just sitting there like, I want to do that. That looks really cool. Yeah, I don't know. I was a big roller skater when I was younger, and so I remember going to the basketball court with my roller skates on. And that didn't work out, and so I took the skates off. But the ball took.
Wow. So you played 4 years, as we mentioned, at Susquehanna, and then went to Iowa. And we wanted to know what the interplay, if anything, was for you between writing and basketball. Are there any skills or ideas that you developed in basketball that transferred to writing, or vice versa?
Yes. Well, I feel like because I pretty much like retired from basketball, like, I mean, I played senior night, and then if I was going to play anymore, I would have had to go overseas, but I got into graduate school. So I feel like I often, when I'm not sure what I'm feeling as a writer, I think about when I felt that way as a basketball player and what was going on and why. And so I often think some of the skills that translate are more like your mindset in yeah. terms of like training, because I was a hardcore athlete growing up, I wasn't really a big reader, and it wasn't because I didn't necessarily like to read. It's just that I had such a Eurocentric education that very rarely did I find anything that interests me. And so I often would just not, because I just didn't want to.
Right.
And then it's not until I began being a writing major, and I had a professor that actually, he went to the writer's workshop too. He was my first writing teacher. And he was the guy that would work out. He wasn't an athlete per se, but like he would lift weights and stuff a lot. I'd see him in the gym, and he would always go back and forth with me about the reading thing. And I would just be like, guy, like, you know, I was a hip hop fan, you know, hip hop can kind of, you know, those rappers would be like, I don't listen to anybody, I listen to me. And so I was kind of like, you know, pig headed in that way. And then there was just one day that he was like, you know, it's just like lifting weights. Like, if you don't work on your jump shot, you won't get better. If you don't read, you're not going to get better. You know, and I was like, oh.
Wow.
I get it. Like, I was like, oh, so I just have to train. And essentially, you know, growing your muscles, you just need to, like, grow your brain, you know? So I think my work ethic has come from my approach to basketball, which is just you have to work every day just to get yourself a chance at success. But nothing's really guaranteed. So I'd say my approach to writing is very influenced or informed by the way that I approached basketball.
I always felt I played 2 years of soccer in college. I wasn't, you know, it was a D1 team. It was a good team. I didn't play much, which is why I only played 2 years, and then I quit to write. But it was painful stopping. It's interesting to me that you didn't play again, because I didn't play soccer again for like maybe 15 years. Are you still off the court, or have you go back after a little while?
I will shoot around sometimes. Like I will run open gyms sometimes. I usually am at the court shooting around by myself, and I usually get pressured into playing because there's a court that has 9 guys and they need one more to play, and I'm like messing up everybody's flow if I won't just run. So usually I'll just play. But honestly, it's funny. I feel more that way a bit about like the weight room, where I was done playing and I was just like, you guys can't make me lift weights anymore.
I hate lifting weights.
But I do play. Like, I was shooting around yesterday. It helps me clear my – it helps me think, honestly, because shooting is such a mind-numbing thing to me. Like, it's just I've been doing it for so long that I don't really think about it. And so I often think about my writing while I'm shooting around.
Oh, that's cool.
So it's sort of meditative, it sounds like.
Very much so, because I feel like the other day I was having a really good thinking day, and I kind of looked up and was like, man, I haven't made a shot in a while. But I got some really good thinking done, so it was all productive.
It's so funny. There's not a similar thing like that in soccer shooting. Like, because when I scrimmage, I find it mentally exhausting because there's a lot of thought about where players are moving and where you need to be, and I don't do any thinking at all when I'm scrimmaging. It's good for turning off my mind, like if I'm playing, but there's no, like, shooting baskets in soccer, oddly. It's boring to just sit there and kick at a goal.
Yeah, I think that's what drew me to it, is just the simplicity of it, which is just that, you know, you can play a whole game, but you can also be by yourself and still get a whole workout in. I think that's probably what drew me to it.
That sounds like writing.
Yeah.
So, Marcus, you know, in your excellent novel, Team 7, which we love reading, basketball is also important to the main character, Andre. And it would be great if you would read a little bit of Team 7 for us.
Sure. So Team 7, the main character's name is Andre, and he is a young man growing up on the edge of Boston, a town called Milton, Massachusetts. And he's a basketball player, and he's first-generation American. His father is a reggae musician, and he is an athlete, though a lot of the sports are off-camera. So here, I'll read from the section called Chocolate Chip. Me and BZ had just come from chilling at Kelly Park. He was hungry, and I needed some zigzags. BZ grabbed the door handle and froze. Fuck. His arms tantrumed out to his sides as he limboed back toward me, bouncing at the knees. Go, nigga, I nudged him in the back. Look inside, he elbowed me in the chest, all we need on a Sunday. I got a nauseous tingle in my stomach. Sade Fulton was there with her pops. He's my regional all-star team coach, forever rocking them black Undertaker shades and cussing somebody out on his cell phone. The type of cat that turned a phone call about practice into a 45-minute hot seat roast session, wanting to know my dreams, where I saw myself in the next 10 years. My plan to combat the white man's glass ceiling system. He drove a sexy chromed out black on black 745 Beamer, a nice sound system, but he didn't play music in his car when he rode with us when I rode with him to our games. He told me what he had to say was more important than anything the crackerjacked radio box could tell us knuckleheaded kids. He drove by us every day after school, never stopping to politic. He'd just thump on by, slow freezing every nigga in their pose. Rumor is he used to be a dope boy, but I don't know. Shit. My plan was to stoner glide the Sunday breeze. All I did know was he'd spoiled Sade into a rotten bitch. He was standing at the counter filling out a money order slip. The mean mug on Sade's face stanker than a bowl of chitlins. Mr. Fulton had on a black Adidas jogging suit with a Sunday Boston Globe tucked under his arm. Sade was behind him holding up a lip gloss. Mr. Fulton answered his cell phone, and we seized the moment and broke. Sade acted like she ain't see us hiding in the back near the water cooler and fresh fruit. She stood there, stone-faced, sucking on the lip gloss that she hadn't purchased yet, slow and steady, like it was a popsicle or a cigarette or something else. Gawking and thinking about her lips, she glanced over. We met eyes. She folded her arms and rolled her eyes, craning her body away from my direction. She's too much. The baddest dark-skinned girl in school, but a crazy bird brain, too. A bad bitch that knows she's a bad bitch, the worst and most dangerous kind. She always had the freshest Jordans on, wrist dripping with gold bamboo bangles, air swinging low with door knockers. She's been crumbs in my bed ever since we went out for 3 weeks last school year. We never broke up, but we fizzled out. she's been evil glaring me ever since. She likes to start shit for the sake of starting shit. Mr. Fulton got off the phone and glanced around the store. I hunched into myself and acted like I was trying to read the back of a box of Theraflu. He paid and walked out the door. Sade moved up in line to pay. She looked through Tanetta, gave her one of them blank stares the way people do at ATMs. She dropped her lip gloss on the counter like she was rolling a hand of dice.
Thank you so much, Marcus. God, what great characters.
Thank you.
So a lot of the basketball that Andre plays takes place off screen in the novel, and what we see is mostly his life in the neighborhood, like that scene. But I'm really interested in the figure of Mr. Fulton, who seems like he's similar, I mean, in some ways to the kind of AAU coaches we hear about in the news. And usually we hear about that, yeah, in the context of those coaches who maybe with the help of an Adidas sales rep are doing something that the NCAA would disapprove of. And here Andre sees Fulton as a straight arrow, like kind of a law and order guy. And I'm wondering if you had a coach like that.
Oh, God, yes. I had many coaches like that. I mean, I had many coaches like that. Well, I mean, I'd say the biggest one that I had, I mean, I don't know. It's questionable about, like, his character, if he's a decent individual in life. But, like, he told me straight one time. I won't name him. He told me straight. This was a coach that I had that was running an AAU program. He was probably making over $100K a year doing it.
Man, that's a good deal. I'd take that.
He's probably made himself a millionaire by now. And he said to me one time that he was the biggest con artist in the city of Boston. And I was like, oh my gosh. And this was in reference to me telling him that I was mistreated in an ambulance after I'd gotten injured. And he yelled at me and said, well, why didn't you call me? And I was like, 'cause I called my mom. And he was like, I'm the biggest con artist in the city of Boston. You always call me. And I was like,
oh my God. Oh. God.
Wait, okay. So you were in an ambulance because you got hurt playing ball or got hurt doing something else?
No, I got hurt playing ball.
Okay.
And that chapter's in the new book. I got injured playing basketball, and I encountered some really, I mean, I'm pretty sure they were racist EMTs, and they really didn't want me in their ambulance. And so it was the middle of the winter, because, you know, basketball was probably around this time of year. It was late February, and I'd gotten injured. I had a high tertiary sprain in my ankle, and I couldn't walk. And they were taking me out of the gym on the gurney in my uniform, so I'm hot, I'm sweaty, it's the middle of winter, and I'm like, excuse me, I need, like, a blanket, my coat, like, it's cold outside. And I was on the phone with my mother because they didn't let me get my things, and so I called my mother, and I said, like, Ma, they won't let me get my stuff. And so the lady was like, give me that phone. She took the phone from me, and I don't know what took place between her and my mother, but all I know is she just said, this is an ambulance, we're not a homekeeping service, and hung up on my mother.
Oh, my God.
And so when that happened, I said, like, you know, y'all can just let me out of this ambulance. Like, this is not going well. And that's when the second I said that, she said, like, I don't know. She said, like, code red into her little microphone thingy. And then they stopped the ambulance. They opened the doors. And we sat there and waited for the police to come.
Wow.
Oh, my gosh. Marcus, how old were you?
I was probably 16.
Oh.
I was 16. And it was kind of, it was amazing because, I don't know, I feel like you start to learn about racism in the world, where it was interesting because I was at a really fancy private school. And so, you know, if it had been a year before when I was in public school, I don't know what would have happened to me. But the reason that things kind of worked out is because one of my affluent teammates' mothers, who was a lawyer, was following the ambulance, and she got that lady fired, I believe.
Oh my God, Boston.
Ooh, Boston.
Well, I mean, while we're here, we wanted to ask you what you were working on. I guess, did you say you were writing about this? I mean, that's the sort of rumors we're hearing, is that you know, there's going to be a sort of follow-up to Team 7, and that there was a chapter from the new novel in McSweeney's in last spring, right?
Yes. I published a chapter from the novel in McSweeney's last spring, and I am working on a follow-up. I'm actually working on, I guess I'll just say it, it's a trilogy of books. Though the concern is kind of varied, where it's kind of funny because people say that Team 7 is a basketball book, and Sugi had mentioned, you know, most of the basketball happens off camera. And that's just because I feel like in the first book, the phases of basketball that he was in were not as interesting as the ones that he goes into. Mm-hmm. And so in the first book, you don't really see that much basketball. But in the next one, you'll see a lot of basketball where he spends a lot more time just at the gym. And you get more of the AAU stuff just because that's like another world. I mean, I think if people aren't familiar with it, they'll be blown away with just, you know, like I played for an AAU team in high school. But I mean, we were traveling around the country and I don't know who was paying for all that stuff.
We're talking about and getting at, you know, wealth and money and race. And speaking of all this stuff, have you been following the FBI investigation into the payments made by shoe companies to college basketball players? Because, you know, the LSU coach Will Wade, after Yahoo News reported that he'd been caught in a wiretap saying that he made a strong ass offer to recruit a player, you know, he was suspended. So are you, what are your thoughts about, you know, money and amateurism and college sports?
Honestly, I think it's ridiculous. I guess I'll say I think it's ridiculous in the way that I think it is. I don't know what word to use to describe my thoughts on the way that the NCAA, I mean, to me, it's like akin to slave labor. Like, I mean, the NCAA makes millions and millions and millions of dollars off of athletes. And the best thing that people want to say is, well, they're getting an education.
I mean, are they?
And I was going to say, like, a lot of times, like, I don't know. I feel like a lot of times when people say that, I'm like, you didn't play college sports. Because I'm just like, I remember my freshman year, we were playing in. So when I was in college, we switched conferences because of academics. So my first year, we would have games anytime, you know, Tuesday, Wednesday, it didn't matter. And so there were times that you get back to campus at like 1 or 2 in the morning, you got an 8 a.m. class, you got to do homework. Like, no. Like, I don't know. I feel like, I don't know. I just look at it like, why is it okay for kids that want to be musicians, kids that want to be actors? They, you know, like, there's kids that are little movie stars. They don't have any college trouble with amateurism and stuff. I mean, I guarantee if a kid that was a movie star wanted to go to college and join the theater program and help out, there wouldn't be an issue with that.
I know. And I was thinking about, like, a student in my creative writing course. If they, like, sold a book, I wouldn't be like, well, I'm sorry. You're going to you're not going to be able to take that money. We're going to take it for us. But you can sell it later after you graduate. Maybe you'll sell another one.
Yeah. I don't know. I think, to me, it's, I don't know. I wonder why people are so against it. You know, like, well, why they're against it. And I think that the reason is, and I remember feeling this when I was a college athlete, where there was one day, there was some fraternity boys in the weight room with us. And I feel like their hatred for us was almost, like, palpable. Like, you can, like, almost feel it where I was. And so I sat there and I looked at them and I thought, like, why do they hate us so much? Like, I was like, what did we do to these guys? And then I was like, and then I thought about it. And I was like, well, these are the same guys that come to our games and all this stuff. And I was like, oh, it's like jealousy. And then I was like, oh, I'm playing D3 sports. You know, like, these guys are Division I athletes. Like, those are coveted spots. And so I think that it's really easy to, like, pull a red herring or a false correlation where you try to say, like, oh, it's bad for the sport that we pay these guys because look at their lifestyles and stuff like that. But I mean, I've still yet to hear a valid argument as to why it's a bad thing to pay players, especially because there's players that are going to get out of college too injured to continue.
And I mean, I think also it's impossible to not look at, right, I think particularly in college basketball and in college athletics and in sort of the premier sports in general, like the way the prevalence of Black athletes, and to think about how race plays into that. Because, you know, I'm thinking about we did an episode on mass incarceration, and Zach Lazar was describing Angola to us and describing prison labor. And it's just hard to not put all of this into the context of the racial politics of this country. And to be someone who loves sports, people talk about this, like loving sports and thinking that athletes should be paid or are in opposition. And I think actually, like, you know, if you love sports, why would you not want athletes to be treated well? You know, to be someone who loves teaching and, you know, who's taught college athletes, and to want the best for them. Like, why would you not want them to be supported?
If the players went away, there would be no system. And I think that it's also predatory because they're often going into economically disadvantaged areas to get these players. You know, like, I mean, I don't know. I was around, I hung around a Division I program for a while as a part of my recruiting, and I saw a lot of illegal stuff going, so I'll say about that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that stuff that you, when we talk about the Will Wade stuff, like, you're like, that's not surprising.
Oh, no, not at all. Like, I mean, it's because to me, it really starts with AAU. I played for a team that was sponsored by Nike when I was an AAU player. Now, usually the school that you choose needs to align with your program. So that's where him saying that, like, he was trying to get some kid to come to an Adidas school. He probably played for a Nike AAU team. And that's why he's probably on.
And so, I mean, you're depicting this world in fiction in what you're working on now. And you were saying that in your upcoming book, there's a lot of basketball. And, you know, I grew up reading the Washington Post sports section, which was one of the country's great newspaper sports sections, and just loving reading about basketball in particular. And I'm curious, you know, obviously you're following the news. Who are the sports writers whom you love, or are there great depictions of basketball in fiction that you can point us to?
Actually, I really liked Grantland, actually. While Grantland was around, they were my favorite.
Yeah.
That was a good website. I still listen to Bill Simmons' podcast. He's pretty good on, he's funny about the NBA. He knows a lot about the NBA, although he likes all Boston teams. So I don't know, maybe you'd like that, Marcus.
Yeah, I was going to say, I never have issues with the things that he says. You know, honestly, I really like listening to Jalen Rose talk about sports.
Oh, yeah, he's good.
Yeah.
He and Simmons used to have a show together, didn't they?
Right. And I, honestly, it was great. They used to do a show called Storytime with Jalen, and he would tell all of the, like, off-the-court stories. And sometimes, as interesting and glitzy as the game is, the stuff that happens outside of the game is way more interesting. Like, the stuff that goes on in the hotels, like, all the nonsense that happens that you're not actually able to tell the coach about. Oh, it's lovely.
Lovely.
Look, we all studied, and I think we might all know each other because of the fact that we studied with James McPherson at Iowa, and he comes up on the show a lot. And I was thinking about if I'd ever talked to him about sports, and I don't think I ever did. But he does have this essay in his essay collection, A Region Not Home, called Grant Hall, that's kind of like an anti-athletics essay. Are you guys familiar with that piece?
Yeah.
I am familiar with that piece. It's funny. I did study with Jim as well, and I don't recall ever really talking about sports with him. I was only a year removed from being a college athlete myself, and so it was something that I didn't really want to talk about because I think I was still working that out of my system, trying to become a little more human.
He talks about the way the athletes that he runs into at Grant Hall in particular are sort of like, they're like Spartans, you know, and they're in that way that they're also like hedgehogs. They know one thing that they know how to do really well. And he talks about wanting to become an Athenian who can, you know, skip around and improvise and doesn't have to be aligned with one particular group. And that was one of the things that for me was, you know, the team concept of being part of the team is so intense when you're playing athletics, but also it is limiting. Like it was something my teammates did not like it that I read and like took creative writing classes and gave me shit about it all the time. You know, I don't know. Was that true for you?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I feel like they didn't, I mean, they gave me shit about it sometimes, but honestly, it was more tongue-in-cheek because I think they all really thought that I was, like, pulling their leg, you know, like, where, you know, because they'd all be like, you know, they all had a joke where they'd be like, oh, yeah, you're writing a book, like, put me in your book, man, and I'd be like, you don't really mean that, because I'd have to, like, look at your life, and, you know, I'm your teammate, I know your life, you know, kind of like, you don't want that. I remember one time we were on a road trip, and, a book came out that I wanted, and this is back when Borders was still around, and we were at the pregame meal, and I asked my coach if I could go to Borders and buy a book, and he looked at me like I was sick. He was like, you know, if you want to call your girlfriend, just say so. And I was like, no, coach. No. Like, I was like, no, really, I just want to go buy a book. And then when I came back with it, you know, everybody looked at me like I was a Martian. They were like, wow, like, you're really going to read this book with all these words? And I was like, I am. So, no, I think they were more confused by it a little bit, but they were pretty supportive. I would say, like, my teammates, honestly, I was sent to Susquehanna by the coaching staff, or at least somebody on the coaching staff at a Division I program. They're not there anymore. And when I decided that I wanted to write, he was really angry. The coach that I told you was making all the money, he mm-hmm. was really mad. Because we weren't happy at Susquehanna at all. And he wanted us to leave. And he wanted me to come to Carnegie Mellon. And at the time, they didn't really have a creative writing program, I don't think. Or at least not that I could find. And then he either wanted me to go to Carnegie Mellon or to Robert Morris. And Robert Morris, Mike Rice was coaching there, and Mike Rice had been abusing players, and like I'd already worked out with him before, and I was like, oh, there's no way in this world I'm going to get mixed up with that crap. And then he freaked out on me in such a real way. Like, he said to me that he pulled up the statistics of people that make money graduating from college and people that do writing are at the very bottom. He told me that I was going to be suicidal and an alcoholic.
Well, I mean, those things are true, but what an asshole for bringing it up, for crying out loud.
And so, you know, every time I get writing news, I think he always gets a little nervous.
So, Marcus, it would be, I think, wrong to let you go without asking you who you have picked as your final four in your bracket.
Well, I won't tell a lie. I have not looked at a bracket quite yet, but I will give you guys a final four.
All right, let's have it.
I will say, you know, I don't know if like this.
I mean, we can't really pick. Yeah, out. We don't. There's no bracket. We can't really
okay,
choose
I was
a bracket.
Say, all right,
there's
I,
no bracket.
I was gonna...
This is Whitney stepping in to say that we recorded with Marcus and Shira on the Friday and Saturday before brackets were released, so we have not seen the brackets at this time.
Say, Duke, Gonzaga, UNC, Tennessee.
Oh, Tennessee. That'll be nice. The yeah. coach at Tennessee left Texas. I'm in a Big 12 town, and so that'll really make everybody in Texas happy if he makes the Final Four.
Oh.
Rick well, Barnes.
Oh, yeah. I'm supposed to say Texas Tech. Yeah.
Texas Tech. Oh, yeah, yeah. Wait, how come they're not in the Final Four, Marcus? They got a good team this year.
I was going to say, honestly, ever since I took the job, I started watching, and I was like, oh, boy, they are actually pretty good.
yeah.
So, yeah, I'll swap UNC for Texas Tech.
There you
about
go.
That.
Go Big 12.
And when this episode drops, it will be Thursday, so actually the tournament will be kicking off.
Marcus, thanks so much for joining us. We're looking forward to the new book, and we encourage everyone who hasn't already to go out and buy Team 7.
Thanks for having me, guys.
This episode of Fiction Nonfiction is brought to you by The Great Courses Plus. And we're just going to tell you a little bit about our experiences with it. We're always trying to be smarter versions of ourselves. And listening and watching The Great Courses Plus has been a great avenue to do that. It's a wealth of information available. It's a streaming service and features some of the best college professors across a huge variety of areas of interest. And there's a nice advantage, the no pressure of homework or exams, which I personally enjoy. You know, I was a good student once, but
no more tests, man.
No more Scantron forms for me. So you can enjoy lectures on topics like Russian literature, Watergate, paleontology, Tai Chi, and that's just naming a few. I mean, it's really, it's a pretty impressive library of information, and there's always something new to explore, which makes it a lot of fun, and we have an offer that's especially for FNF listeners.
Oh yeah, okay. We're going to give you a better deal even better than what we've been given, which has been it's going to be a free trial. Plus, if you sign up for it, you can lock in a $10 per month charge for signing up for a 3-month plan of using the Great Courses Plus. That's a 50% off the regular price. I have been listening to Sci-Fi Science Fictionist Philosophy this week, which is totally awesome. And the reason is that this is a really great philosophy professor who's giving the lectures, but he's using movies that all of you will have seen. So he's talking about like The Matrix and The Matrix Reloaded. He's actually making you think The Matrix Reloaded is better than it probably is. But he's talking about like Calvinism and free will. He talks about Inception, the movie Inception, and the interpretation of art. He talks about the Adjustment Bureau and fate. And these are like, it's an incredibly smart idea of like crossing science fiction and the way that science fiction delves into like profound and interesting philosophical concepts. So he's talking about The Matrix, but he's also talking about Baudrillard, you know? So it's just fascinating stuff.
And when I've looked at the lectures, I think one of the things that impresses me is how inclusive the syllabi seem. That's really something that I look for as a teacher and that I appreciate. And I also appreciate it as a student, a non-Scantron taking student. But So we know you're going to love the Great Courses Plus 2. And so we have a limited special offer for our listeners, that free trial that Whit mentioned. And you can lock in the lowest price of $10 a month when you sign up for a 3-month plan. And that's 50% off the regular price. And it's a great deal, and you can get it by going to our special URL, which is thegreatcoursesplus.com/lithub. And again, that's a free trial plus 50% off your monthly plan at thegreatcoursesplus.com/lithub. And now we're thrilled to welcome Shira Springer of Boston's NPR news station, WBUR. At WBUR, Shira covers stories at the intersection of sports and society. You can hear her radio features on NPR and WBUR, and she was a staff writer at the Boston Globe for almost 20 years, and while she was there, reported on all 4 major Boston professional teams, the NBA Finals, the World Series, the Olympics, and the Boston Marathon.
Oh.
She was the Celtics beat writer for 7 years and also an Olympic columnist and women's sports columnist, and she continues to write columns on women's sports for the Globe and Sports Business Journal. She's the winner of national awards for investigative sports journalism and feature writing, and she ran college track and cross country. Shira, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
It's great to have you here. Earlier this year, you published a couple of articles about coverage of women's sports and highlighted basketball, in particular through a conversation with Sue Bird of the Seattle Storm. You picked out Sugi's favorite WNBA team, the Minnesota Lynx, which have the coolest name of any professional sports team, in my personal opinion, and the Minneapolis Star Tribune as an example of women's teams getting good coverage. What are they doing right?
I think it starts with consistency. You know when the Star Tribune is going to cover the Lynx. You know you can expect it there on a regular basis. So I think it all starts with consistency. They have committed to coverage. They are doing games. They are doing features. They are doing analysis. They send columnists to games. All of that is important. And also they give it a prominence in the newspaper. You'll see it on the front page of the sports section. You'll see it in the Star Tribune's magazine. And they do big profiles. And I think another factor is they also treat it like they would treat any of the men's professional teams. And that sometimes means being critical. So some of their analysis, some of the reporters' analysis of the team is critical. It's critical of the players. It's critical of the coaches. So all of that combined really makes that good coverage.
I love the piece that you wrote for Neiman Reports about this, you know, ways to improve coverage of women's sports. And sports coverage to me, and the way it relates to writing and literature, is that what's most important about it is narrative, and it's generational narrative, right? So when you talk about that consistency of coverage, it's that the narrative has to be consistent. You have to know, like, why it matters, how the Lynx are doing this year as opposed to 2 years ago, and how this player, you know, has overcome this problem that they had, you know, 4 years ago. That's the kind of thing that I follow in sports, in men's sports. You know, is that what you're talking about in that kind of consistency of coverage?
Yeah, you bring up a really good point. And what's interesting about women's sports and sort of problematic is that it hasn't been around for that long. And you don't have that sort of institutional memory. So you don't have all this great history and this great wealth of narrative to draw from. Right. And it's so important that the writing we do now about women's sports establishes that narrative, because there are great stories out there to tell. And that was really Sue Bird's point, which is like, tell our stories, dig into them, tell about, you know, give us a sort of, make female athletes three-dimensional, which is something that doesn't always happen. So I think you're absolutely right. There needs to be attention to the narrative of female athletes and also the narrative of their teams. You know, you're lucky there with the Lynx in that they have they have a storied history. I mean, they have been the most they've won the most WNBA championships in league history. So they've been incredibly successful, and there's a wealth of stuff, a wealth of stories you can choose from. And I think the Star Tribune makes good use of that and makes good use of that history. But not every city is lucky enough to have a team like that. Not every athlete is lucky enough to play on a team like that. So it is, I feel, the responsibility of news outlets to really start telling these stories and telling them on a regular basis.
So have you seen coverage of women's sports over the period of time that you've been a journalist? How have you seen it change?
Not enough. You know, I wish it had changed more. I mean, in the story, I point out how coverage of women's sports only accounts for 4% of total sports coverage in the U.S. And that's a really paltry number, given how many women are engaged in playing sports at all levels. But I think what's interesting is, you know, since I've started covering sports, you've had the addition of ESPNW, which is this platform that's totally dedicated to women's sports, which is nice. But I've personally been impressed with some of the smaller enterprises that are out there and doing coverage, whether they're feminist podcasts like the Burn It All Down podcast.
Yeah, that was fun to read about. I didn't know about that podcast.
Exactly. And it's a great listen. And it's really fun to just hear what they have to say and hear a group of women talking sports, not necessarily women's sports, but just talking sports and viewing it through a feminist lens, which is always really fun. There's also, I don't know if you're familiar, a website called Equalizer Soccer. And that's women's soccer. It's dedicated entirely to women's soccer. And I know exactly where I will be going for the in-depth Women's World Cup coverage that I want. I will be going there. And there's other entities that I mention in the article, like Her Hoop Stats. And I actually just met with the founder of Her Hoop Stats at a sports analytics conference. And I mean, and he's doing vital work.
You know, I remember as a kid, I was a tennis player in addition to a basketball watcher and also a tennis watcher. And I remember all of these things about women's bodies and women's clothes and like the way that, I mean, when a woman's body becomes the object of viewing, how does that affect the writing and who's doing the writing?
Well, first of all, not enough women. I think the percentage is somewhere around 10%, you know, of women are in, the, you know, of our women are editors. And that's where the real problem, I think, exists, because if you have men doing the primary decision making about how sports gets covered and who gets covered, then it often means that women's sports don't get covered as much as they should. It also impacts, you talk about image, it also impacts photo selection, you know, the photos that go with the articles. But as far as like, you know, how the type of or the gender of the writer affects the coverage, I think it's just it's a question of, I look at a female athlete when she's competing much different than a male colleague does. And you know, I may have some male colleagues that object to that, but I'm sorry, it's true. I would bet that I am much more focused on how she's competing, her athleticism, her skill level, her talent level, And not so much focused on how she looks or what she's wearing. I mean, I just cringe now, and I still can't believe it's done, when I read a lead about a critical match, whether it's a tennis match or even a critical basketball game, or, you know, it's a track race, you know, or a marathon. And, you know, somewhere in the lead, there is a sentence or even a half a sentence that focuses on how a female runner looks and, you know, connects her look to her accomplishments.
I was asking that question, I think, thinking specifically about Claudia Rankine's Citizen, which includes material on Serena Williams. And what a pleasure and also revelation it was to look at Serena Williams through Claudia Rankine's eyes. And I was thinking about, you know, as a kid, I read a ton of sports fiction, and I was always looking really specifically for feminist sports fiction, and still have some of those books that I read when I was a kid, you know, The Girl Who Joins the Boys Baseball Team. And I remember there was a series for kids.
In Does which the Bad News Bears then count?
No, definitely not.
Probably
but
not.
But then they had a really good female pitcher, though. Wasn't she like their savior?
That was the whole idea.
Yeah.
I think I was the kind of kid who was perhaps not allowed to watch the Bad News Bears.
Oh, okay. Well, we just watched it over at our house last night. My kids learned a lot of new words. It was very fun.
That's why I wasn't allowed. But there was a sports writer, John Tunis, who wrote a series of books in which each book focused on a different sport. And then the tennis book focused on women. And I'm going to go ahead and spoil the end of the book here. At the end of the book, the woman tennis player gives up in the final of, I think, Wimbledon because she wants to get married. And I remember I've never felt so much like just hurling a book across the room, which I would never do, but also just was just so ticked off about it.
Would you mind if I just like wander a little bit from my earphones, because you were talking about fiction, and my mom was cleaning out her attic, and she found a book that she bought me, and it was about a woman running the Boston Marathon, and I can see it on my bookshelf. I'm just going to grab it.
Yeah, okay? Good. Let's go ahead.
Okay. I've got it. And it is a love story, I think. So I'm just going to describe it. She said she must have found it in some old discarded bin, because it's quite old. It's called, the title is The Girl Who Wanted to Run the Boston Marathon, because at the time I was young, but I had always had a fascination with running the Boston Marathon. This is a novel by Robert McKay. And This is the description on the back cover. You ready?
I'm ready.
Chris was literally knocked off her feet the first time she met Skip. She'd been running laps around the reservoir, preparing herself for the Boston Marathon when they collided. At first, she thought he was quite ordinary. Then she realized he was special. Not only good looking, but ironically, a world-class runner. Fate united these star-crossed lovers and then conspired to separate them before they had even begun to enjoy their love. So it's supposed to be a story about a woman who wants to run the Boston Marathon. And now I have to admit, I may have read it a long time ago. I don't remember. It's you know, it's a 190-page paperback. I should probably read it. But it certainly seems like this book about that you would think of from the title, like, oh, all right, female athletes, go, is really about this woman falling in love.
I loved reading these books by R.R. Knudsen, where this girl named Suzanne, nicknamed Zan, plays a different sport in every book. And she runs the 1984 L.A. Marathon in one of those books, and she wins. And she never falls in love anywhere in any of the books. I loved these books so much. This girl was such a good all-around athlete that in every book she would play a different sport. And there was one in which she played basketball. And it was probably the first novel I read in which a woman played basketball. And I tore through that whole series really, really fast and loved it. I remember the ending moments of that marathon book. If she makes friends with a Chinese runner and they run together at the end of the marathon. And I must have read that book in 1988. So it really made an impact on me.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, yeah. And it's unfortunate. You know, you'd hope that there would be more books like that and fewer like The Girl Who Wanted to Run the Boston Marathon.
Right. Or The Girl Who Gives Up in the Wimbledon Final to Go Get Married.
He can't just
wait until after the final. I mean,
yeah.
Well, speaking of books and writing, and you wrote a terrific essay for an anthology about sports what ifs, and your sports what if was about the 1936 Olympics. It's got some great hypotheticals and political analysis in it. We wanted to know if you'd read a little piece for us.
This is from the book, Upon Further Review, The Greatest What Ifs in Sports History, and it's a book edited by Mike Pesca. So we'll pick up here the sort of the day after or the morning after the U.S. has voted essentially to boycott, or the powers that be in the Olympic movement have in the U.S. have voted to boycott. Headlines around the country and overseas spread the news. U.S. says nine to Nazis. AAU backs Olympic boycott. Mahoney calls on other nations to follow. President Roosevelt on way to Middle West, silent on sports leaders' decision. No Olympic glory for world record holder Buckeye Bullet Owens. The AAU vote shocked Olympic caliber athletes around the United States. While they heard the boycott talk led by Mahoney and countered by Brundage, many never imagined they would stay home. They were too good, too much of a main attraction, too integral to any sports competition organized for the world's best. And so the U.S. boycott struck a crippling blow to the Nazi Games. But that was not how American athletes wanted to use their talents. Leading up to the vote, they spoke strongly against a boycott. Black sprinter Ben Johnson even confronted Mahoney during a Columbia University symposium, telling the AAU president he should put his own house in order before criticizing others, and citing discrimination against black athletes in the United States. Owens, Ben Johnson, Ralph Metcalf, Cornelius Johnson, and Ulysses Peacock, all African-American track stars, wrote to Brundage in favor of participating in Berlin. For Owens, it marked a reversal of earlier radio comments, but more accurately reflected his eagerness to compete on the world stage. Now, with the boycott news, U.S. athletes were reeling with disappointment, frustration, and anger. They saw a missed opportunity to show up Hitler, especially for African-American and Jewish team members. It was easy to envision African-American athletes, especially Owens, as counterarguments to Hitler's Aryan ideal. Owens was barely 6 months removed from the greatest track and field performance ever. At the Big Ten championship meet, in the span of 45 minutes, he broke world records in the 220-yard dash, 220-yard low hurdles, and long jump. And he tied the world mark in the 100-yard dash. And he had competed that day with a back so badly injured, he had almost withdrawn from the meet. Some might call that record-setting Big Ten performance miraculous. But Owens had nothing on Betty Robinson. After winning gold in the 100-meter dash at the 1928 Amsterdam Olympics, she came back from the dead. In June 1931, she was involved in a biplane crash and found unconscious beneath the wreckage. She was placed in the trunk of a car and driven to an undertaker, then was discovered to be alive. Robinson had a deep cut across her forehead, a left leg fractured in several places, and a broken left arm. No one thought she would race again. As the 1936 Berlin Olympics neared, she couldn't bend down into a proper starting crouch, but she would earn a spot on the 4x100 relay. Or she would have. More than 300 other American athletes would have joined Owens and Robinson in Berlin, all with compelling personal stories and impressive athletic resumes, and almost all would be lost to history because of the boycott. Great Britain and France quickly followed with Olympic boycotts of their own, adding to the number of athletes left with disappointment, frustration, and anger instead of medals. Both European countries had long worried about Hitler as Olympic host and long debated what to do. Like U.S. sports officials, members of the British Olympic Association and French leaders doubted Nazi assurances that Jewish athletes would be welcomed onto the German team. They also feared the reach of Hitler's propagandistic ambitions. The absence of Great Britain and France, two of the biggest teams after the German and U.S. delegations, would turn the Berlin Olympics into little more than a sports exhibition. That would tempt other countries to boycott, too.
Shira, thanks so much for that reading. It's interesting to think about the kinds of protests made possible by boycotts and the kinds of protests made possible by participating. Of course, I think of the NFL and Colin Kaepernick, but also the Lynx and other teams that have participated in protests, for example, you know, wearing shirts to support Black Lives Matter. Some critics have noted that those protests preceded some that got more coverage done by male athletes. What do you think of how social justice work done by male and female athletes and by black and white athletes has been covered in recent years.
Yeah, I do think that the protest work and the protest staged by female athletes certainly get a lot less attention unless they are about things like pay equity. I think that has become sort of, for good reason, a very buzzy topic around sports. And we've seen that recently with the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team.
Filing
a lawsuit for pay equity and also for, you know, better support and better resources. And, you know, we see that's always a constant topic within the WNBA and by WNBA players is, you know, getting better pay for the players. And we all know a couple years ago when the U.S. Women's National Hockey Team threatened to boycott the World Championships, which were going to be held and hosted in the United States, and they threatened to boycott it unless they got better pay and better support and better resources to develop their game, both at the elite level and at the youth level. So I think it's interesting. Unfortunately, some of the social protests that female athletes do get overshadowed by the social protests that male athletes do, particularly when it comes to NFL protests. But gradually, and maybe not even so gradually, I think there's been actually a pretty steep learning curve and a good learning curve for female athletes, recognizing that if they time things right, you know, whether it's before a major championship like the women's hockey team did, or filing a lawsuit on International Women's Day, that they can sort of generate a good deal of publicity and attention and prove to be very savvy about how they proceed with a campaign for either, you know, their own pay or perhaps other social issues.
The one thing that I was thinking of that was interesting to me about the protests that involved the women's national soccer team is that in their case, you know, they have this argument that in fact they are more successful than the men's team. You know,
mm-hmm.
And also just as popular, you know, if not more popular. And so this has been traditionally the argument like, OK, women's sports don't draw viewers. But that is not the case with women's soccer. And there are some other examples that I've seen you cite, you know, the UConn women's games at the University of Connecticut get higher ratings than the Red Sox. And you also wrote a column about how La Liga in Spain has sort of been promoting women's soccer successfully. I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit.
So a couple of things. You know, with regard to the women's national soccer team, it always strikes me as like, you know, they're campaigning for equal pay in my book. And I don't know how you guys feel about this. I think they should actually get paid more. They draw more attention to soccer in this country. More
right.
people
yeah.
follow them. They draw, you know, bigger crowds for all their games. I mean, this. I would ask this question. I mean, to any average soccer fan in the U.S., can you name five players on the men's national soccer team? I bet you most people would draw a blank. And I'm talking soccer fans. And I bet if you ask that same question to people about the women's national team, can you name five players on the women's national soccer team? I bet you would get people who could name, if not five, then three or four. I mean, I think that people are just more aware and more, and quite frankly, more interested in the women's soccer team.
Right.
And they should be paid accordingly. And that means more than the men. Okay, that's my soapbox moment. So with regard to, you know, the question about, you know, yeah, UConn women's games, the women's basketball games get higher ratings, bigger audiences in Connecticut. No surprise to me as somebody who grew up in Connecticut 20 minutes away from stores. It is fascinating to live in that environment because women's sports are not only do people pay attention to them, but people respect them. You know, people talk in casual conversation like, well, I'll be home for Thanksgiving, and people will be talking about the women's basketball team at UConn. It is something that people are interested in. It's part of that sports banter that you get a lot, you know, with men's professional sports in general.
It's obvious to me that there is an audience for this because, and I judge it by basing on how I watch, you know, parents, because I have two sons who are 9 and 13, but I go to a lot of sporting events in the, like, you know, between third grade and high school level, and like, you know, there'll be a women's volleyball tournament at the same place where my son's having a soccer game, and that place will be packed there will be parents ravenously watching all of those games, intensely interested in their daughters and their friends' daughters playing volleyball. So obviously, and it's not like they're not saying like, "Oh, we don't want to watch this," you know. Like, there has to be a way for that interest that happens at the high school and like middle school level to carry through.
Yeah. And I mean, I think it starts with something we were talking about earlier, which is consistency of coverage. Like, that's what you have in Connecticut, too. I mean, you have it in the Star Tribune with the Lynx, but you also have it in the Hartford Courant with the UConn women's basketball team. I mean, they are covered extensively. And so if you want to know about them, if you want to know the narrative of the season, you can easily find it in the Hartford Courant. So I think that's a big deal. Now, you were asking also about La Liga. As well, and sort of
which is the professional soccer league of Spain, for those who don't follow that.
Yes, and they have been very aggressively promoting, as you mentioned, women's club soccer in Spain. And part of that is because I believe it's 12 men's teams also have a women's side. And I think kind of the lesson there that I took away after talking to the head of what they call the head of women's football, women's soccer, a guy by the name of Pedro Malavia in Spain, and just talking to him, and one of the key things they did is because there's such fierce loyalty to Spanish club soccer. I mean, people live and die for FC Barcelona, you know, and the teams in Madrid and so on and so forth. They basically, and the teams in Bilbao, and, you know, they basically said, if you're a fan of FC Barcelona, you're a fan of FC Barcelona. And that means the whole entire club and all that this club represents. And this club represents a women's side and a men's side. And then they did this really clever campaign called We Speak the Same Game. And it was clever in its simplicity in that it was just top players from, you know, both the men's and women's teams of this, of the same club. So Barcelona, Bilbao, Valencia, etc. And they had them just sitting side by side in the same uniforms, the uniforms they would wear during a game, talking soccer, talking about their passion for soccer. And it was that, you know, the optics were great. And the conversation was great, too. But it was seeing them as equals and sending the message like, this is the same thing. They're talking about football is football, you know, in Spain. Soccer is soccer. And I think we don't get a lot of that in the United States. I think part of that is, it's, you know, we have to work at it. It has to be marketed. It has to be pushed better. You know, the NBA can do a better job with the WNBA. MLS can do a better job. I mean, they don't have to, but, you know, they should want to do a better job with the NWSL, the Women's Pro Soccer League. The NHL can do a better job with the Women's Pro Hockey League. By the way, hat tip to Minneapolis again with the Whitecaps. The women's pro hockey team there, they're doing phenomenal.
What's going on up there, Sugi? How come all the good women's teams are in Minnesota?
It's like the water in the 10,000 lakes. What can I say?
I was going to say, what is it? And they're getting attention and they're selling out. I think, you know, they're selling out at like record rates, their games and stuff like that. So it can be done. But it requires effort and it requires consistency. And, you know, and until you have that, it's, you know, it's going to be difficult to make progress. I also think, you know, one of the things I brought up in the article about women's sports coverage is it's going to take some reworking of the culture in sports departments, because the culture as it currently exists prioritizes the coverage of men's pro teams. And I don't mean just in terms of what you see in the paper, but in terms of how you advance your career. So when I was coming up, the goal was to get on a men's pro sports beat. So I was always working toward covering the Celtics or the Red Sox or the Patriots. For me, it ended up being covering the Celtics for several years. That mindset has to shift. You know, you have to provide a path to career, you know, of a career advancement that goes, that leads to coverage of women's pro sports teams or women's teams. It has to be seen as a prestigious beat the same way a men's pro team is seen as a prestigious beat. So there are cultural aspects that have to change within sports departments. I'm not sure they necessarily will, given the current state of newspapers. So my hopes are kind of pinned on the podcasts, you know, like Burn It All Down and the you know, the enterprises like Equalizer Soccer, which are kind of doing it from the bottom up, so to speak.
So, Shira, I think before we sign off, we definitely have to ask you what teams you're following in March Madness, which women's basketball teams are the ones to look out for in this tournament?
Oh, come on. UConn. Women, go Huskies, right?
Well, I grew up on that like you, so.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it'll always be the Huskies. I mean, I, you know, like I said, grew up 20 minutes away from stores, so I can't, you know, root for any other team, though they're going to have a tough road to the Final Four. And I think that's great because, you know, we all know for so long they were dominating women's college basketball. Not that that's a bad thing. You know, I think dynasties are good, but I also think parity is good too. And the suspense that comes. I mean, again, talking about narrative, having that suspense in there, you know,
what's so who are their happen. Challengers? Who could take them out?
Oh gosh. I think Notre Dame is looking good. Baylor was looking good.
Yeah. I'm a Big 12 guy because I live in Kansas City. Baylor women's team being very good.
Okay. I was gonna say Baylor, Notre Dame is looking good. Who else was looking good that I've seen play? Louisville is looking good. So those I think, you know, if I were to pick a Final Four, obviously the brackets haven't come out, but like, you know, for those people who are filling out brackets at home, my very, very premature Final Four, I would say Baylor, UConn, Notre Dame, Louisville. How does that sound to you?
Sounds excellent.
Okay.
Thank you.
Louisville's a little bit of my dark horse.
All right. Well, I'll put that in for extra points in my bracket.
You're going to be in my women's bracket. Awesome.
If it even lines up. Or you can go with how my nephews fill out brackets, which is simply by mascot. Like, they're young. It's like mascot appeal. So, yeah.
Animal cuteness for the win.
Yes. Or animal ferocity in their case, you know. Tigers are better than this. They don't get the whole leprechaun thing. It's very confusing to them. So, you know.
Wait until they find out about the fight in Quakers. Shira, thank you so much for being on the show. A real privilege to listen to all of this expertise on a topic that is so dear to me. And we look forward to reading more of your work.
Thank you. And thank you for having me. This is fun.
That's it for the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast. Our theme music is composed by Travis Workman. Credit for the music bed and our Great Courses Plus promo goes to Damian Josiah Johansson and Anthony Bell. You can subscribe to us by typing fiction/non/fiction into the search bar of your favorite podcast app. You can also listen, find previous episodes, and read excerpts from our interviews at the Literary Hub website, lithub.com, where the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast page is listed under the News tab. If you enjoy the show, you can do two easy things to keep us in business. Sign up for the Great Courses Plus free trial. If enough of you do, that will make them want to sponsor our show in the future. And give us a rating on iTunes. We'll post a link to the books we referenced this week on Facebook at FNF Pod and on Twitter at FNF Talk and on Instagram at fiction.non.fiction.podcast. Happy reading and rock chalk Jayhawk.